Good afternoon, comrades. Welcome to our Sunday afternoon discussion group hosted by the Consistent Democrats. Now we're doing chapter 4 of Lenin's State and Revolution. Ian's going to talk for about 20 minutes, half an hour.
Something like
that. And then we will open it up for discussion. I remind comrades that we are being recorded. So, ideally, people could remain muted until called to speak, which you can indicate when you want to speak. And please keep it to one at a time. Thank you, comrades. Take it away, Ian.
Okay.
Yours.
Thank you very much. Right. Okay. This is about State and Revolution, Chapter 4. Which is Supplementary Explanations by Engels. And it's a substantial chapter, actually, divided into six subsections, which are on the housing question, on a controversy with the anarchists, a letter to August Babel, criticism of the Erfurt programme, is a section on the 1891 preface by Engels to Marx's The Civil War in France, and finally Engels on the overcoming of democracy. So that's quite a lot. I mean, and all these sections embody an underlying theme. They cover a lot of ground in drawing more generalised conclusions about the lessons of the Paris Commune and the importance of these lessons for distinguishing genuine socialism, which you could call Marxism, I suppose, from parliamentary opportunism. Now, it starts off with citing Engels on the housing question, about reforms and the requisitioning of property. And this is by way of a preface to more substantial sections to come. I'm going to quote a few bits and pieces. For instance, Lenin quotes Engels regarding housing as saying this. He says, "One thing is certain. There is already a sufficient quantity of houses in the big cities to remedy immediately all real housing shortage, providing they are used judiciously. This can naturally occur only through the expropriation of the present owners and by quartering in their houses homeless workers or workers overcrowded in their present homes. As soon as the proletariat has won political power, such a measure, prompted by concern for the common good, will be just as easy to carry out as are other expropriations and billetings by the present state." And then he continues quoting Engels, and there's quite a chunk, actually. It says, I'm not going to rephrase all this, because there's not much point. You know. He says, "It must be pointed out that the actual seizure of all the instruments of labour, the taking possession of industry as a whole by the working people, is the exact opposite of the Proudhonist, that is the anarchist, redemption idea. In the latter case, the individual worker becomes the owner of the dwelling, the peasant farm, or the instruments of labour. In the former case, the working people remain the collective owners of the houses, factories, and instruments of labour, and will hardly permit their use, at least during a transitional period, by individuals or associations without compensation for the cost. In the same way, the abolition of property in land is not the abolition of ground rent, but its transfer, if in the modified form, to society." So, to summarise, Lenin again cites Engels' formulated position from that adopted by the Blanquists in France after the Commune, which is the following. He says, "It's on the necessity of political action by the proletariat and of its dictatorship as the transition to the abolition of classes and with them of the state." So that brings us on to the controversy with the anarchists, which is somewhat a bit more meaty than that. It was first put, you know, this discussion that Marx and Engels with the anarchists was first published in an Italian socialist annual in 1873. It wasn't actually published in German until 1913, which of course is relevant because we're talking about Germany and the SPD here to a very large extent as the central sort of Marxist organisation in Europe at the time. So, the essence of it was this. There's a quote from Engels, I think. It says, "If the political struggle of the working class assumes a revolutionary form, and if the workers set up their revolutionary dictatorship in place of the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, they commit the terrible crime of violating principles. For in order to satisfy their wretched, vulgar, everyday needs, and to crush the resistance of the bourgeoisie, they give the state a revolutionary and transient form, instead of laying down their arms and abolishing the state." And that's extracted by Lenin from that discussion in Italy, I believe. That's the essence of the Marxist criticism of the anarchists. Not for rejecting the state as a supposed norm of society, but for rejecting the special kind of transient state that the communists advocated as a means for crushing the bourgeoisie. So Engels ridiculed the so-called anti-authoritarians, the Proudhonists and similar people, who repudiated all authority, all subordination and all power. And he noted that this implied rejecting revolution itself in practice. As Engels is quoted as saying this, he said, "Have these gentlemen ever seen a revolution? A revolution is certainly the most authoritarian thing there is. It's an act whereby one part of the population imposes its will upon the other part by means of rifles, bayonets and cannon, all of which are highly authoritarian means. And the victorious party must maintain its rule by means of the terror which its arms inspire in the reactionaries. Would the Paris Commune have lasted more than a day if it had not used the authority of the armed people against the bourgeoisie? Cannot we, on the contrary, blame it for having made too little use of that authority? Therefore, one of two things. Either the anti-authoritarians don't know what they're talking about, in which case they're creating nothing but confusion, or they do know, and in that case they're betraying the cause of the revolution. In either case, they serve only reaction." But there's more to this. I mean, Lenin points out that the social democrats of his day had never argued against the anarchists as Marxists. They'd done it rather differently, as he explains in the following passage. He says, "Social democrats, claiming to be disciples of Engels, have argued on this subject against the anarchists millions of times since 1873, but they've not argued as Marxists could and should. The anarchist idea of the abolition of the state is muddled and non-revolutionary. That's how Engels put it. It's precisely the revolution in its rise and development, with its specific tasks in relation to violence, authority, power, the state, that the anarchists refuse to see. The usual criticism of anarchism by present-day social democrats has boiled down to the purest Philistine banality. We recognise the state, whereas the anarchists do not. Naturally, such banality cannot but repel workers who are at all favour of thinking and revolutionary-minded. What Engels says is different. He stresses that all socialists recognise that the state will disappear as a result of the socialist revolution. He then deals specifically with the question of the revolution, the very question which, as a rule, the social democrats evade as an opportunism, leaving it, so to speak, exclusively for the anarchists to work out. And when dealing with this question, Engels takes the bull by the horns. He asks, Should not the commune have made more use of the revolutionary power of the state, that is, the proletariat armed and organised as the ruling class? Which I think sums it up pretty well. But he then goes on to deal with Engels's letter to Babel, August Babel, that is one of the key founding leaders of German social democracy, in March 1875. See, what Engels was doing was criticising the Gotha programme, which was the earlier draft programme of German social democracy when it unified in that period. There were two factions that reunified, the Eisenachers and the Lassallians. And the Lassallians were somewhat distant from Marxism, at least initially. So the programme was a bit of a hodgepodge. And taking up the question of the state, Marx, Engels wrote, Lenin quoting Engels, he quotes him as saying this. He said, "The free people's state has been transformed into the free state. Taken in its grammatical sense, a free state is one where the state is free in relation to its citizens, hence a state with a despotic government. The whole talk about the state should be dropped, especially since the commune, which was no longer a state in the proper sense of the word. The people's state has been thrown in our faces by the anarchists to the point of disgust, though already Marx's book against Proudhon and later the Communist Manifesto say plainly that with the introduction of the socialist order of society, the state dissolves of itself, that is, disappears. As the state is only a transitional institution which is used in the struggle, in the revolution, to hold down one's adversaries by force, it's sheer nonsense to talk about a free people's state. So long as the proletariat still needs the state, it does not need it in the interests of freedom, but in order to hold down its adversaries. And as soon as it becomes possible to speak of freedom, the state as such ceases to exist." So, indeed, Engels said that the attacks of the anarchists on the social democrats were in part justified, insofar as the so-called people's state was as much an absurdity and as much a departure from socialism as the early formulation of a free people's state. You know, and, when Engels raised this with Babel, he claimed to agree with it. You know, he said that he fully agreed with his opinion, with Engels' opinion, that he's on the draft programme. And yet, when Babel issued a pamphlet called Our Aims in 1886, it included this formulation. It included the formulation that said, "The state must be transformed from one based on class rule into a people's state." So it appears that Babel's verbal abstract agreement with Engels, that agreement was negated by the social pressure of the political environment that the Babel and the SPD actually operated within. And that brings us on to the section on the Erfurt programme, which was the more developed programme of German social democracy that was adopted in 1891, which was 8 years after Marx had died, of course. Yeah, Marx died in 1883, I believe. So Engels criticised this document for faults on the question of democracy and the state at several levels. There was opportunism in the SPD, in fear of a reprise of the anti-socialist law, the anti-socialist law was in existence from 1878 to 1890, and it basically prohibited much in the way of socialist politics and activity, and the SPD was semi-legal that way, you know. And so this opportunism, effectively, that's what it was, as Engels was talking about. This was expressed in the SPD's failure to challenge the legal prohibitions on the demand for a republic, and its acceptance of a federal constitution in Germany, which when they should have been demanding a unitary republic. Now what Engels was only really was touching on is the question of the need to combine illegal and legal work, as the Bolsheviks did in Russia, of course, with ultimately great success. But Engels was critical of the SPD in this way. He says, they push general abstract political questions into the foreground, thereby concealing the immediate concrete questions, which at the moment of the first great events, the first political crisis, automatically pose themselves. What can result from this except that at a decisive moment the party suddenly proves helpless, and that such uncertainty and discord on the most decisive issues rein it in because these issues have never been discussed? This forgetting of the great, the principal considerations for the momentary interests of the day, this struggling and striving for the success of the moment regardless of later consequences, this sacrifice of the future of the movement for its present, may be honestly meant, but it is and remains opportunism, and honest opportunism is perhaps the most dangerous of all. If one thing is certain, it is that our party and the working class can only come to power in the form of the democratic republic. This is even the specific form for the dictatorship of the proletariat, as the great French Revolution has already shown. Now, just to clarify, that was not a statement that the advent of a democratic republic would be synonymous with the dictatorship of the proletariat. It was rather a countering of the opportunism of the SPD for not even raising the question of a republic. In a constitutional setup, which I think even Babel himself stated that it was a fig leaf for absolutism, i.e. basically behind the constitution the Junkers ruled, you know, the Prussian aristocracy and the Prussian monarchy basically ruled. Now for brevity, I'm leaving out two questions here which are a bit more complex and don't really quite fit into this discussion. One of which is Marx's view that was referred to by Engels, that a peaceful overcoming of capitalism might have been possible in late 20th century Britain because of the absence then of a bureaucratic state. Personally, I think Marx was mistaken here, but I don't think that's actually quite what we're discussing. The other question that I'm going to mention, but not really go into detail about, is the aspects of the national question which occur in this chapter. For instance, about the Federal Republic being a correct demand in Britain. But Engels also supported the autonomy of US states and similar things in Australia and Canada, etc. And he also made remarks about how ruinous the Swiss canton system was. And he correctly rejected the dismissive attitude of the national... this is Lenin, actually, more so. Lenin links this with his own rejection of the dismissive attitude to the national question of some Polish and Dutch Marxists. But these are worth discussing, and they're probably a separate subject. But we haven't really got time to go into detail on those here. But irrespective of that, all that brings us on to is Lenin's exploration of Engels' 1891 preface to the Civil War in France, which summarised the lessons of the Paris Commune. And it did so in this way. It says this, in France, Engels observed, the workers emerge with arms from every revolution. Therefore, the disarming of the workers was the first commandment for the bourgeois, who were at the helm of the state. Hence, after every revolution won by the workers, a new struggle, ending with the defeat of the workers. And Lenin continues, he's citing Engels about the state in this context. Engels says this, he says, it was precisely the oppressing nature, the oppressive power of the former centralized government, army, political parties, bureaucracy, which Napoleon had created in 1798, and which every new government had since then taken over as a welcome instrument and used against its opponents. It was this power which was to fall everywhere, just as it had fallen in Paris. From the very outset, the Commune had to recognise that the working class, once in power, could not go on managing with the old state machine, that in order not to lose again its only just gained supremacy, the working class must, on the one hand, do away with all the old machinery of oppression previously used against it itself, and on the other hand, safeguard itself against its own deputies and officials by declaring them, all without exception, subject to recall at any time. And then Lenin actually comments more on this. He says, Engels emphasised once again that not only under a monarchy, but also on a under a democratic republic, the state remains a state, i.e. it remains its fundamental distinguishing feature of transforming the officials, the supposed servants of society, its organs, into the masters of society. So Engels here approached the interesting boundary line at which consistent democracy on the one hand is transformed into socialism, and on the other demands socialism. For, in order to abolish the state, it is necessary to convert the functions of the civil service into simple operations of control and accounting that are within the scope and ability of the vast majority of the population, and subsequently of every single individual. And if careerism is to be abolished completely, it must be made impossible for honourable, though profitless, posts in the civil service to be used as a springboard to highly lucrative posts in banks or joint stock companies, as constantly happens in all the freest capitalist countries. And of course that's very familiar, isn't it? It happens all the time, and we can see it happening in front of our very eyes as we watch what's going on today. But he concluded this section by saying this. He said, two more remarks. One, Engels' statement in a democratic republic, no less than in a monarchy, the state remains, quote, a machine for the oppression of one class by another, by no means signifies that the form of oppression makes no difference to the proletariat, as some anarchists teach. A wider, freer, and more open form of the class struggle and of class oppression vastly assists the proletariat in its struggle for the abolition of classes in general. And two, why will only a new generation be able to discard the entire lumber of the state? This question is bound up with that of overcoming democracy, which we'll now deal with. So there's some discussion here where they talk about the inadequacy of the name Social Democrats for the socialist movement in Germany and elsewhere in the period of the Second International. And then they talk about the name of the Bolshevik Party in Russia. This is Lenin discussing it on a later scenario, of course. It's worth reading, but it's tangential again. So I'll just mention it and encourage comrades to read that. But on this question of the withering away of even democracy, Lenin writes this. He says, in the usual arguments about the state, the mistake is constantly made against which Engels warned, and which we have in passive indicated above. Namely, it is constantly forgotten that the abolition of the state also means the abolition of democracy, that the withering away of the state means the withering away of democracy. And Lenin addresses those that might suspect that this is some kind of elitism being brought in. And he says this, we set ourselves the ultimate aim of abolishing the state. All organised and systematic violence, all use of violence against people in general. We do not expect the advent of a system of society in which the principle of subordination of the minority to the majority will not be observed. In striving for socialism, however, We are convinced it will develop into communism, and therefore that the need for violence against people in general, for the subordination of one man to another, and of one section of the population to another, will vanish altogether, since people will become accustomed to observing the elementary conditions of social life without violence and without subordination. And in order to explain, to emphasise this element of habit, Engels speaks of a new generation, reared in new free social conditions, in which he will be able to discard the entire lumber of the state, of any state, including the democratic and republican state. So, in order to explain this bit, this point, you really need to go on to the next chapter, which we will do so in due course, which will be to analyse the economic basis of the withering away of the state. So I'm going to conclude there, because that really is the end of the substantial meat of this chapter, and I'll open this up for discussion. Thank you, comrades.
Thank you. Who would like to comment or contribute? Those of you not on camera, please use your virtual hands. Those on camera can give away their physical hands over to you. So who wants to start?
I've just got to admit two more people have arrived. Let me let them in. Looks like this didn't work entirely. As long as you can't... you can't handle this registration business while you're giving a presentation. Anyway, that's on the by and by. I think Susan and Mark are on their way.
Are they?
Yeah. That's what I was talking about. Sorry about that. The problem is that I can't handle registrations when I'm giving a presentation. We'd have to think of how we sort that out. Anyway. Who wants to speak? Sorry, Paul, your turn.
Yeah, my connection froze briefly for a second. Yeah, did anyone want to speak on this text? Maui, do you want to speak? You're muted at the moment. Ah, there you are.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you, Ian, for making this text available for discussion and for your introduction. This is quite a feat because there is so many ideas in this document. About what you said about the first part, which was an analysis of the housing question, just to go back to that a little bit, to make it a little bit more pointed, Engels had noted that under the commune, there was still such a thing as expropriations and billetings, like happens in the he was saying, in the state where he was, which was a capitalist state. Engels was living this, and the commune still was functioning with these things and such a thing as rents. And so I think this is very important because it belongs to the whole discussion. So the commune was not the elimination of the state. It still functioned with the state. The rent didn't disappear in the first during the commune, and Engels had noted this. From this, Engels had drawn conclusions. Rent did not disappear, the state didn't disappear, the commune did not disappear, the state. And that's just very important, because when we talk about the commune, sometimes people say that was the first proletarian state, but it didn't have time to get there. And then Lenin returns to this with the taking of power. He says, we still operate the state. We make it work for the interests of the majority. We employ officials. We refer to standards. And all this for distribution still for in the interest of the majority, instead of it being in the interest of the minority when the state was in the hands of the capitalists. So Lenin says, as we have risen, have we taken power from the capitalists, we subdued the yoke of the capitalists. But for a time, for a whole period, the commune had to use the power of that yoke, the yoke of the state, the power of the bourgeois state, in the interests of the majority. So Lenin, I think that Ian pointed this out, Lenin says this is because the transition to a situation in which it will be possible to supply houses rent-free all round depends on the complete withering away of the state. And you see here the economic base that has developed, so that the revolution can actually fulfill itself. The state cannot be wished away or discounted as if it did not exist, because for over a period of time, the revolution still has to handle it, whilst the advance of democracy is pushing down and pressing down on what is left of the state. And when finally there has been enough time for the masses to create their own democracy, then the state withers away. It no longer needs to function, it stops functioning. So these are key ideas, which I'm sure people have already seen, but it's worth returning, because it is, in this country, we are in a political culture of social democracy. And this document explains how the mishandling, misunderstanding and opposition to these ideas happened in the social democracy of Germany, and that was at the time of the creation of the SPD in the 1870s, there with Engels, and then eventually with Kautsky and others. There's two leaders who are mentioned. It's August Babel. So this man, he was a foundational German social democratic politician. So he helped. He was an MP in the Reichstag, and he helped with the formation of the SPD. That was in the 1870s. And then William Brack, or Brake, was a prominent German socialist publisher, politician, and also participated in the development of the Social Democratic Party. And the Social Democratic, the SPD, was the German section of the Second International. And, as you all know, the Labour Party was the British section of the Second International. And therefore, we need to know about all these things, because we are facing them now. This analysis, which has been made first by Marx, then by Engels, then Lenin, on the nature of the state and how it doesn't just, you cannot wish it away, that was directed at the German Social Democrats. They had the view that, we are not anarchists. We do not say that we are against the state. We don't agree with the anarchists with that. But though they did not agree with the anarchists, they had something in common in the sense that for them, the state was that that thing that perhaps you could just take over, and eventually you make it socialist, or you have a people state, and everything gets modeled in such a way so that you do not need revolution. And which is exactly the position in the Labour Party, you know. I'm sure in the United States this is taking place in different ways, but this is a reformist way of looking at the historic process, which is afraid of the transformation, of the level of transformation which is required, and which is silly, really, because we are not going to achieve this by means of superiority of weapons. We are going to achieve this by means of the intervention of the whole population to actually rule itself and become human instead of being a dependent on power and the power of fate and the power of God, that the human being starts controlling their own lives and organizing their own society. This is an act, a revolutionary act, but it's also a very simple one in the sense that it has been done several times in human history. It has been attempted and it has succeeded in key parts of the world. So I just would like to bring that a little bit to a close. I would like to speak again about the question of how this applies to the Labour Party. See how this question of social transformation, when Engels was in front of the Earthworld program and he could not talk about republic because that would have landed you in jail, then he proposed another formulation to be put in that program. And this, therefore, is giving us ideas how tactically, how do we go from now to the next stage tactically, not just with big ideas, but with precise tactical ideas on how to go about elevating and putting the social democrats in front of their own contradictions. So, yeah, I'll stop here and I will come back if I can later on. Thank you to everybody.
Thanks, Marie. Very good contribution. Did anyone want to come in on that or any other part of the text? I've got a comment that I would like to make, and that is, I was interested in what Marie said about the power of commune, because I've heard other Marxists who are not Trotskyists at all, who talk about why the power of commune failed, and their argument, I won't name names, but this person's argument was that the problem is the power of commune wasn't a nation state. Well, as Marie had demonstrated, it's actually more complicated than that, because what Marie had demonstrated is that the existing state was still in existence. So the argument that the power of commune failed because it wasn't a nation state, it wasn't a material reality, because the existing state was still in existence. So I find that an interesting analysis. So that's my own contribution on what Marie just said. I thought it very interesting. Does anyone else want to come in, either on the text or on what's just been said? Marie, if you want to say something else, maybe this will be the time to do it.
I'm sorry, because I don't want to stop other people. I know it's difficult for people to decide to say something, but they could always find something to say, and then we discuss it.
But nobody has indicated that quite.
Okay, then I'll carry on. I wanted to say about the commune. Ian has mentioned it. I would like to go back to it. The commune was crushed, right? So you could say, had it disarmed, then perhaps the bourgeois class would not have attacked them. Well, this is not so, because as soon as you raise a little finger to show that you want power against the power of the minority starts organizing itself clandestinely if they feel that they must do that, and then they prepare. The bourgeois class prepare the organs and the methods by which they are going to strike at the revolution at every level. And so even if we had done like was advised by the anarchists, we just take the state, we take the state power, we haven't got yet socialism, we just got hold of the state, and then we just manacled the bourgeois class like this, and we press it down. Throughout this process, the bourgeois class prepares for the counter-revolution, and so at this point, to give up the weapons would have led to an even greater bloodbath. And so it's important then to say, with Marx, I think Marx and or Lenin, would it not have been a better thing for the commune to have used the state power, the power that it had captured, against to go further in its revolution, instead of advising? This was not said to the commune, it was said to the anarchists who were proposing that it should have given up its weapons. Not only shouldn't have given up its weapons, obviously it didn't, but it was not a thing to advise that it should. It, on the contrary, one should advise that this power should be used to advance further and to defeat that counter-revolution, to foresee the counter-revolution and to defeat it, and to allow the masses to come further against the state, start demolishing the state further. Yeah, this is what I wanted to say.
Thanks, Marie. Ian, do you want to come in? You're muted, though.
I muted myself. Okay. Yeah, just a few things. I mean, I'm not going to say a great deal. I think there doesn't seem to be any real dispute over any of this, as far as I can see as yet. But yeah, I mean, I think the point about the Paris Commune is that this thing about it not being a nation state. Well, that was a flaw because. Really, socialism in one city or a worker state in one city is not going to last long unless it actually does lead to the overall state power being liquidated and replaced with that state. And the problem is that the commune basically didn't attempt even to branch out and to extend itself across the whole of France. It was an anomaly. It seemed like an anomaly at the time that a revolutionary government had come into existence only in Paris. And, obviously the forces of reaction gathered themselves in Versailles, which is to the east of Paris, and they were allowed by the... because the circumstances of the Paris Commune was the defeat of France in the Franco-Prussian War. And that the Germans allowed the French bourgeoisie to crush the commune, which was hardly very surprising. The Germans, although the Germans were not directly involved in the conflict as regards the commune, it was not surprising that they wouldn't want to see a revolutionary workers' government set up in an area that's contested by them, So it's hardly... surprising that the German bourgeoisie let the French bourgeoisie crush the commune, and of course it resulted in a major repression and executions of many communards, and we all know this, But it needed to be able to extend itself. I mean, obviously, the circumstances of the defeat of France were possibly not the... it's one of these situations where you get a revolution comes into being when a state is defeated. but there are other forces involved, and it's very difficult. But there's also the main difficulty was the ideological unclarity of those leading it. You know, they were a mixture of anarchists and putschists. You know, the Blanquists had no idea really about how to lead a revolution. They thought leading a revolution meant you just gather as many people together as you can and launch an insurrection, irrespective of the temper of the masses and the consciousness of the masses, and that would inspire the masses to follow. And that didn't always happen, of course. That was the politics of the followers of Blanqui. And there were other people. There were Proudhonists and Bakuninists and whatever. And the relevance of all this, of the controversy with the anarchists, of course, Marxist controversy with the anarchists, was that these ideas were actually there in some form or another in the commune, you know. And so it's not an academic question. The commune was not led by revolutionary Marxists. It was led by people with a hodgepodge of different views that were sort of revolutionary in temper, but not really clarified. And that's why, you know, in some way, that's part of why this material is important. The other reason, of course, is that Lenin is, you know, polemicizing against the crimes of the and betrayals of the Second International, which, of course, you know, the State and Revolution was actually written in 1917, in the middle of 1917. And he's exploring all these questions and explaining to the about the whole question of the attitude of Marxists to the state and how we can actually have a revolution in Russia. That's basically what it was all about. You know, he was, you know, sort of going through the lessons of history and of the obvious previous example of a workers' state that briefly existed, albeit only in one city, you know. You know, what Marie says is true, and what Paul said is true, in a sense, that what you're referring to, anyway, is the you have to capture state power, you have to have a revolutionary dictatorship, and just one city, even a large city, is not enough, you know. You have to take overall state power and destroy the other side. And because the commune only excluded the bourgeois power from Paris, it didn't succeed in destroying the overall bourgeois power in France, which of course had the sort of passive support of the German bourgeoisie who had defeated it. So it was an anticipation of what would happen in other revolutions, and that's why it's worth analysing from the point of view of the state. And that's what Lenin was doing, in citing Engels on all these different questions. Anyway, I'll be there. I think Max wants to say something.
Go ahead, Max.
In respect to this, I just want to throw something out there. I mentioned in the chat. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I have to, for some reason, I have to unplug my headphones to make the sound work. I don't know why. I read this chapter before the meeting. I was thinking about my experience in DSA and with some of these other social democrat types in New York. You know, mostly between 2017 and 21, maybe. Anyway, was wondering maybe people could respond to my question. Like, things would arise, like, oh, we're going to have a slogan of abolish the police. We're going to push people like AOC and, you know, do electoral things. Okay, that's number one. Especially the slogan abolish the police. My question is, because as a real, what I consider a good worker communist, I'd say, I know something's wrong with that, but I can't verbalize it and find the correct analysis back to this kind of material from 100 years ago. But I know it's there. Maybe you get somebody to clarify that. And quickly, oh, shit, to the other point, which I'd lost my train of thought, was something similar. Oh, yeah, like just the whole experience. I kind of went into this because I had met some Woods Grant people from the Marxist tendency in 2017 at an anti-Trump demo downtown New York. And I thought, geez, I didn't really know about this. I remember the Sparks used to talk about the Grant text, but I didn't really know. So I want to find out for myself kind of thing. So I went to a couple of their meetings. I opened my mouth about De Leon. I questioned a couple of the things they said, and within 2 or 3 weeks, they sent me an email asking me not to attend their fucking meetings. Then, as I say, fucking, I was a little mad at how quickly I realized they don't want somebody with their own taste. They just want somebody. But also they told me that they were entering into DSA to see if they could form. So that kind of gave me the idea to join DSA, just because at that time it was growing. Now, I already had a knee-jerk reaction way back from DSOC in the 80s, not to waste my time with that kind of people. But at that moment in 2017, I went to the meetings. And one of the things I noticed, every time I join a group, I join caucuses that claim to be more revolutionary, I join the various working groups. What I noticed above all was that this, I mean, you had to be an idiot not to know, or not an idiot, but like not a communist. You know, these people were not doing anything. In fact, it was almost like there was an invisible hand in these meetings. Like, it's just there to make people feel like they're doing something, even though they're not. And some many sincere people were duped, especially young people. Anyway, I don't wonder what anybody's had similar experience with, maybe similar groups in the UK or elsewhere. And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Max. Ian, do you want to come back on any of that?
Yeah, hang on. Mark is just arriving, actually. Mark has arrived. Mark A. anyway, he's hopefully will be here in a minute. Mark has got... There are two Marks now. Hang on 1 second. I'll admit both, in case we don't have one of them working. Yeah, they're both joining now. Anyway, yes, on the question of the police, I think we don't advocate the reform of the police. We don't advocate various things like community control, democratic control of the police. We are for the abolition of the police. How feasible that is to actually raise as a demand depends on the situation. I wouldn't have thought it's very feasible at the moment to raise such a question in Britain or the United States. But then again, I think the abolition of particular organs of the state, like ICE, for instance, I think calling for the destruction of ICE, for the abolition of ICE, and calling for, possibly even calling for a workers' militia to defend the mass of the population against thugs like ICE might be a feasible thing to advocate. But I'm not sure. I mean, there have been occasions where things like demands like defunding the police have actually been, they're arguable in the United States, because I think one of the things about the police in the United States is there's been a huge overkill of, you know, police militarization. In a way that probably hasn't really happened here. I know about the, you know, ICE is one symptom of it, but also, you know, the general sort of climate of reaction and the building up of police state tactics, even before Trump, was pretty heavy in the United States, even going back to the days of Bill Clinton, you know, and his effective death penalty acts and things like this, you know. And so I think the, you know, the militarization of the police in the United States, demands like defunding the police, I think, are slightly different from calling for democratic control of the police. Because what they're saying is we shouldn't be paying all this money for all these cops to these super heavy SWAT teams and things. And whatever they are. I mean, I don't know in detail because I've not lived in the United States, but I know what I've heard about these things, you know, that militarization of the police against populations living in poverty and conditions of oppression is something that's really taken off in the last few decades in the US. And it's pretty ostentatious. So I think the demands for defunding the police are understandable, to be honest. But really, you need to replace, you know, the point is that we are for the replacement of the standing army and by implication of the police force and things like that, with a workers' militia. And that is what we are... you know, that is fundamentally our strategic aim, isn't it? You know, I think that's all you can really say. But you know, I mean, there are conditions where, you know, I mean, there are people who've armed themselves against the police in the United States. The Black Panther Party have done this, you know, and of course they've come into conflict with the cops. They're doing it now, you know. Well, they have been doing it, you know. There have been, you know, the Black Panthers reborn in Philadelphia, things like this, you know. I don't know what's happened since, but that was going on a month or two ago. You know, I haven't heard any great sort of detail about it since, but I think these things are bubbling away, you know. But I think we do have to raise in our propaganda that we want the police replaced. I mean, the funny thing is that in the days of Marx and Engels, in Britain and in France, when they were writing about this stuff, the police were actually very underdeveloped. The police were, you know, in Britain were invented in the 19th century, weren't they? You know, they were a new phenomena, a new sort of force, intermediate with the army and the whatever. It was a civilian police force. It was a new a new development in the mid-19th century. Robert Peel in Britain, you know, the Peelers, the Bobbies or whatever, you know, they needed something other than the army to simply go in and suppress insurrections and things, so they came up with the police, you know. But I think, you know, the question still applies. You know, it probably was somewhat underdeveloped when Marx and Engels are writing about it, but we need to replace the police and the army and all these bourgeois armed forces of repression with our own state, our own militia. And however we, you know, however we argue for that, it has to be argued in some form. I mean, in terms of our programme, in terms of the programme that we're putting forward in your party, there will be, you know, we're advocating a militia, a workers' militia, to deal with the fascists. That was at the time, obviously at the time when your party looked like it could have 500,000 members or something. It doesn't seem like that at the moment, you know. But if it had become the biggest party in the UK, it would have been a resonant demand, I think, you know. It would have been a real possibility to actually get support for it. I think it seems a bit unrealistic at the moment, but it's still correct, you know. It's something we have to find ways to actually propagandise for, you know. I don't know anything more about the situation in detail in places like Brazil. But yeah, Corbyn is not even acting as a decent social democrat at the moment. He's actually sabotaging his own party, and that's a discussion that we'll probably talk about later. But anyway. Paul's the chair, but he wants to speak anyway, so yeah, I'll defer.
Well, you kind of led me to it when you were talking about, I know when we finished recording, you're going to have a discussion on your party anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But you kind of led me to it because there are people in your party that are really divided. There are lots of people that really know not very much about politics. I wasn't going to say the root, but I won't. But then you also get those that are so pro-Corbyn, almost a kind of religious cult mentality that wait for him to say the word, and then they'll all follow suit. And that is not a suitable way to do politics. There are some people that have really got to stop crying and get to grips with themselves and actually analyse what's going on with the world and not to wait for someone to come to the right team, so to speak. That's my take on the situation as it stands. And yes, I do agree with Ian. I think to a large extent, there are people around Corbyn, possibly including Corbyn himself, who seem intent on actually sabotaging this very project. Obviously, that's a personal view, of course. I'll leave it there because Jonathan would like to speak. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, the question of the state in Marxism and Marxist groups, I mean, it's a very complex issue, and it's one where, you know, I've had experience of the complexities. I was in the South End discussing with some Marxists about the state, you know, about an issue. It was about an issue. It wasn't about the state. And they were saying something, and I disagreed with them, and we discussed it. And then at a later day, a Marxist I knew in London, I was telling him about the discussion. And he said, John, these people are coming out with these ideas. They're not Marxist ideas. They're anarchist ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, and they you know, it's not always clear that we have a uniform understanding of the state in Marxist circles itself. You know, there are leaks of anarchism and all sorts of stuff within Marxism. You know, and it's not, you know, although it seems, yeah, Marxism have one position over the state, they don't, because you discuss with various Marxists and they change. I mean, Militant have a certain position about the state, and you know, and their interpretation of Marxism and the state. And but it's, you know, it's to think that there's clarity on the left about what Marxism and the state is. There's just it's a question that I haven't gone into, but it, you know, it's I mean, for example, I know a Marxist who got mugged, and he helped the police try and catch the muggers. Now, I'd be on his side. Now, there would be some Marxists say, no, you shouldn't get involved with the state. And anarchists would say you shouldn't get involved in this, with the state. But in his case, he was quite happy to get involved, and I think he was quite right to. But then Marxists would say no. You know, I've known people who call themselves Marxists who say no, you have nothing to do with the state. You don't get involved in any of its in its operations of crime, but things like crime or anything like that.
My take on that, I'll let Ian come in a second, is that whilst you can have your views about particular bodies of the existing state, at the same time, you still have to deal with the material reality that you live in at the present before you can attempt to sort of change it. You have to acknowledge the world that you're currently within. So yeah, it's not like someone can just come and mug you and then you just, oh, don't worry, I never needed that arm anyway, it doesn't matter. You know. Anyway, sorry, Ian, I've interrupted you there. Sorry.
Well, just on that, I had the same experience. I did get mugged in 2010, you know, by some snotty little white guy in woods in East Dulwich. And I did call the old bill, of course I did. You know, the idea that you wouldn't is absurd. You know, it was quite an interesting take on this, though, the experience, because I was in the police car, and they were radioing, and I'm aware of the codes that the police use for ethnic groups. And so they kept insisting that this bloke was IC3, which means he was black, you know. And I said, so it kept saying, no, he's white. And they had to correct their bloody radio. They just assumed this bloke was black, you know. And he wasn't, he was white. And I had to keep correcting them. So they bloody, the police are, yeah, it's necessary to get the police involved. But you can see the how bloody awful they are. They won't take the word of the victim, that at least initially, the person who mugged them was actually white, you know. It was some snotty little white kid with a knife in some woods at the back of a supermarket when I was taking a shortcut home. You know, that was a long time ago. That was, when was that? That was 16 years ago or something, you know. But yeah, I have had the experience. Of course you wouldn't refuse to call the police if you're victims of a crime, you know. I think if you're victims of a crime, you should... you know, you should defend your rights, including in the existing state, you know. But that's not our criticism of the police, that they might actually deal with some crime somewhere. That's not what we're opposed to. We're opposed to their oppressive function, which is their main function, actually. But we're not opposed to, you know, enforcing your own rights. You shouldn't be robbed with violence, should you? Although actually the bastard actually got away with nothing from me, because I ran away and he didn't get a chance to chase me, really. But anyway, that's on the by and by. In terms of some of the stuff in the chat that Mark put about the people, we can talk about this later, you know, the people in your party and their behaviour is really appalling, but we'll talk about that in a little while, you know. I think John wants to speak again.
Yeah, Jonathan.
No, it's just that you'd find there some Marxists I've found who won't agree with that, you know, about what you just did. They'd say, no, that's just using, you know, that's using the oppressive thing of the ruling class. You know, and all I'm saying is a debate needs to be taken up within Marxism generally about these practical questions and about when, you know, what position you take up in them, because there are anarchist trends within Marxism, I'll leave it there.
Does anyone else want to speak? I'm aware that there's a few of you that haven't spoken yet, so if you have a little thing about what you would like to say, it would be nice to hear from people who haven't yet spoken. Max, go ahead.
You're muted,
Max.
There it is. Okay.
We can hear you now.
Sorry about that. But the word anarchism, I get confused sometimes because there's what I read on paper and there's what I experience in real life. Again, similar to what I said before. But also, in my history of political experience and ideas over 40 decades since I was a teenager, I started with a lot of Deleuze ideas, which I still hold almost viscerally. I don't know why, not just because I got them from my father, but because they make sense. But a lot of people, when I first started hanging around with the Spartacists and I talked to them about Deleuze and also the Grantites decades later, I start bringing up Deleuze and the IWW and the history of American labor, revolutionary American labor. I don't know, maybe from the 1890s into the 30s, before the Communist Party completely took it over, or not completely, but you know what I mean. Anyway, Well, I have a tendency to think anarchist. Well, depending on what that person means by anarchist, could be a bourgeois liberal who thinks, you know, they're radical. And there's anarchism, like they're kind of libertarian, they're kind of wrong. And then there's the people who anarcho-syndicalists. See, that's what I was trying to get to. My personal experience is what I would be dismissed by comrades as a anarcho-syndicalist, which I always thought was kind of a cop-out and bullshit, because I'm kind of rough around the edges and I don't have the greatest polemical, you know, sometimes it's like a chess game when communists argue. And if we want to appeal to the masses, you know, you're going to get people like me too. And other people are rough around the edge. You got to get at what people are really saying. Yeah. Anyway, that was my experience. And also, like, the great cases of Sacco and Vanzetti and people persecuted for being anarchists. But, they, you know, I'm just, it's kind of like feminism, you know, or anti-racism. There's a bourgeois version and there's a proletariat version of these things. So that's then different versions within those. But those, it's like the animal and plant kingdom of life. That, those are the big overriding things that we have to define what we're talking about with our terms. Okay. And
Ian, do you want? Ian, do you want to come back on?
I wasn't going to say much more, to be honest, unless anybody else has got anything to say. I mean, I don't disagree with what Max just said, that there are various, you know, some of these things are tricky and blah, blah, blah. You do have to relate to a lot of different nuances on these things, you know. I think that seems fine to me, you know. I haven't got anything more to add, unless anybody else has got anything they want to add, you know. If not, I suggest we stop the recording soon. And
not yet. I think Marie wants to say something.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's no hurry, but it would be fine. You know. Yeah.
You're muted, Marie. You're muted. Marie, you're muted.
Yeah, that's it.
Ah. We can hear you now.
I don't want to take a lot of time. It seems to me that we can use opportunities like today to draw conclusions more concretely on, you know, about the situation where we are. How does that apply, you know? And this is a question of democracy. Is absolutely actual. People are appalled by the fact that we don't have any democratic expression anymore at any level, practically no level, except, of course, the right to eat, perhaps, if we can afford the food. It seems to me that the commune, the way the commune functioned, I invite the comrades to have another look. You know, I think we could have made much more about it. You know, how did people go about taking power in the commune? They took the legislative, the executive, they took over the civil service, the schools, I forgot the other things. And then they started instituting a same wage for everybody. This is so important, you know. Look how relevant this is to today, where we have reached the point where the distribution of the wealth is not sustainable. And something is going to happen, and these ideas are going to be wanted. And there is no... there's no need to think that it is all a lot of words, but just look into the significance of what's being said and to apply it to today. Yeah, that's it.
Thanks, Mary. Okay, did any other comrade wish to say anything more? I'm getting an indication that perhaps this will probably be the last section of the recording, in which case if nobody wants to say anything, I will make the summing up remarks. We will then click off recording and go to an off the record section of the meeting.
Sure. Sure.
So now, comrades, if there's anything you wish to say, please indicate now. Otherwise, I will formally bring this part of the meeting to a close. So I can't see any further indication. So if it's okay, and I will make the
yes,
yeah, closing remarks, and then we'll turn off. So that so I would like to thank Conway for coming, and I think it's been a very good discussion. I think some of us have probably got a lot more reading to do as a result of the discussion, because I think this chapter was quite meaty, and I think some of us probably need to have a reread, even if it, or perhaps even finish the chapter. But I think it will be worth going over it again. And I think hopefully in a fortnight's time, unless anything crops up, we will possibly do the following chapter. But those of you on the main list will know in due course. So thank you all for coming, and hope to see you next time. And Ian, you can click off the recording now.
I will be.